All right, listeners, welcome back to the Hunt Back Country podcast. We, as you've been following along, hopefully have noticed there's been a gap and we're back. We've been busy hunting, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight and just kind of catch up. It's myself, Steve, and Lenny. We have several hunts to talk about. We have a ton of good shows lined up for the next several weeks and months, really. We already have some recorded we will be releasing. We're scheduling more guests now that we're excited about. You might have heard previously, we mentioned a big giveaway for our 100th episode, which is coming, should be launching around the 1st of November. We are going to have some awesome prizes for you guys just to say thank you for following the podcast, supporting the podcast. So we wanted to make the 100th episode something special for you guys. So over $2,000 so far, and gear will be given away. You guys are surely going to want to catch that. So if you're not already subscribed, be sure that you subscribe. You don't want to miss that one. But with this show, we want to just catch up on previous hunts, tell some stories, share some lessons learned, maybe talk about some good, bad, and ugly. So that's what we'll do. Steve, Lenny, glad you guys could make it, man. Glad you're back in civilization, online, and all those things.
I'm not sure how glad I am.
I'm glad.
Going back to reality.
It was a pretty awesome break from email land that I live in sometimes.
Yeah, that's for dang sure. Yeah, so we already talked about your Alaska trip on a previous episode. So I guess let's go chronological from there. Lenny, start with you, I guess, in Idaho, right? You were the first one to get on a successful hunt after Alaska with the caribou, with the deer hunt. So tell us kind of how that got started.
Yeah, so obviously we went up to Alaska and then got home, and you know, I have a family and two young kids, so I stayed home for a couple of days. But then, right before I off to Colorado, my wife was generous enough to let me get out on a more or less a 1 day hunt before I left for Colorado the next day. So I snuck out, I think on Friday. Yeah, Friday. And so I basically had 1 day to do it. And here in Idaho, it's been real smoky. The forest fires were kind of bad all the way until the 1st of September. And so I got in there as quick as I could that evening and glassed, and not a single buck on the mountain. So I text Steve. I got a new pair of Nikon Edges, and I was like, either these Nikon Edges are broke or this place sucks.
Blame it on the glass.
Yeah, blame it on the glass.
If you had Swirros, there would have been bucks everywhere.
I mean, you know, I got a thing going back and forth on that. Like, oh man, you can't see that. So yeah, it seems like, oh, it's got to be the binoculars.
Which that was a side note there. That was it was really fun because Lenny bought those Edges, and you had researched, Lenny, right, that they had different baffling on the inside to reduce sun glare, right? Yeah, so Lenny and I got to do a lot of side-by-side with the SLCs and Nikon Edges, and I think those binos are neck and neck with each other. I was actually really impressed that the Nikons kind of held their own next to the Swirros pretty much 99% of the time. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's just like they're just better at different things.
Yeah, I'd put that, yeah, for sure. Yep.
So what stands out is kind of the strengths. Where does the Nikon win? Where does the Swirro win?
Like the baffling in them, in the flare and the sun glare and the reflection that you get, you know, and especially like mule deer hunting, there's so many times that you're glassing against that hill where the sun is coming up, and then you get that glare and you literally can't see the hill anymore. Mm-hmm. And what really intrigued me about Nikon is their whole thing is, hey, we put this baffling in there and you almost get zero sun glare. So that's why I bought these. And it's pretty legitimate. I mean, you can definitely glass like towards the sun and have a pretty good view versus the Swirro. Mm-hmm. But the downside to that is, frankly, the Swirro in every other lighting condition, frankly, beats them. Right. They're just a little brighter. The colors are just a little nicer. I can't really put my finger. Brighter is maybe not the right word, but it's just like the Swirros just have a nicer view. I'd say the clarity, neck and neck, mm-hmm. resolution, neck and neck, like edge to edge. I actually think the Nikon's maybe a touch better. But yeah, it was fun to look.
Yeah, that baffling, you know, sounds like a filtering type function. Does that then affect low light performance?
Yeah, so it's actually, if you look on the inside of the tubes on each side, you'll actually see rings in there. And so as the light's coming through, rather than reflecting all the way through and getting to you or something, there's basically no glare. But exactly. The downside is, frankly, is the light transmission is slightly lower in low light situations, or just kind of in almost every condition, it just looks different.
Yeah, it's like I compared it to putting like a pair of sunglasses on, like a very, very lightly tinted set of sunglasses. And so when you're looking into the sun with them, it's freaking awesome. And then
it is.
Every other time, it kind of darkens the image when you're looking into shadows. But man, they were so close. I mean, I would be more than happy to pack either one around my neck. I know that for sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, back to your deer.
All right, aside, optics aside, gear talk aside.
So, you know, I was sleeping up on the hill, side of the mountain, and I'm like, man, I got one morning because I better leave the next day. And so, fortunately, in the morning, a little storm kind of blew through and kind of got most of the smoke out of there. And then, so then the next morning, it's like, oh, awesome, freaking buck. And so I had 8 bucks on the mountain that morning. The same mountain the night before, I couldn't see a single buck. It's amazing that smoke where you can't quite see the contrast. It just kills the glossing ability. And so it was actually a pretty quick trip. It was mostly smaller bucks. I found one buck. He was probably like 160, 170 buck, which I would have been ecstatic with. And he actually ended up bedding down in a pretty good spot. And actually this is the spot where I killed my 190 buck, literally same hill. And so this buck beds down first. I'm like, man, I don't know if he's going to stay there. And that's one thing about mule deer, man. If you've got a long ways to go and you can't watch them from the time that you leave to get over to them, and you got to make sure it's their bed where they're going to be for a couple hours. So this buck bedded first, and luckily, cause I probably would have went after him, but he only bedded for maybe 15 minutes and got right back up and then fed some more and bed up the hillside about another quarter mile. And he ended up bedding in this perfect spot. So I got to drop all the way down this hill, circle all the way back around. It took me 2-3 hours to get over there. And I'm dropping down on him. And I think anybody who hunts by themselves knows that you are so much more patient when you're by yourself. And so I knew I had one opportunity to do this, because once I blew this stalk, I had to go home. So I was like super careful. It was super dry. And I kept waiting for the thermals to kick up. And I'm going down this open hillside in my socks. And literally, I've moved like 5 feet in 20, 30 minutes. Like, I just couldn't get a thermal to push up the hill enough to kind of rattle the brush and give me some sound cover. So I was maybe 150 yards above this buck at this point, from where I kind of thought that he was going to be. And as I was sitting there out in the wide open hillside sun, there's a couple of trees kind of just below me. This little super 2x3 walks up, beds down 50 yards in front of me. And I'm like, are you serious? He's literally like 50 yards from me, and then that buck's between 50 and 100 in front of him. And I'm like, okay, I can't go left. I can't go right. Like, I can't do anything. So I'm sitting there watching that buck, and when he bedded down kind of quartering hard away from me. So, and the thermals were good, so he wasn't going to smell me. So I just kind of right then made a decision. I'm like, all right, a couple of things are going to happen. I hope that big buck gets up and kicks this young buck out of this bed, because it was a nice shaded bed, and I shoot the big buck, or the big buck feeds up here and I shoot him. Little buck goes to a different bed. Like, the worst thing that can happen is this little buck is going to stand up, turn around in his bed, and face me, because once that happens, I'm done. And I know that buck's going to blow over there and take that other big buck with him. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to sit here until one of those scenarios plays out. And if you turn around and face me, I'm going to shoot you.
You're getting between me and the arrow.
Yeah, it just literally like that. And, you know, I ranged him. He's 52 yards, super steep downhill. And I'm just sitting there, and bugs crawling on me and out in the hot sun. And I'm just like, come on, man, something happened. And sure enough, the last scenario happened. And that dang buck stood up, turned around, faced right towards me. And then it was just, Frank, I mean, it was a perfect opportunity. He dropped his head and started kind of pawing at his bed. And so I knew he was going to face me, but with his head dropped, he couldn't see me draw. Drew, shot him at 52 yards. And it was actually kind of a tough shot. 52 yards, he was kind of quartering to me, super straight downhill. So it went in pretty much just right, came right out of his flank. He didn't go too far. And then obviously the other buck was blown out of there, so I didn't even get to see him. But it was awesome. High country mule deer, 2x3, full velvet. I mean, honestly, I was happy as heck I could be with him. And a little thunderstorm blew through, packed him up, boned him out, got the heck out of there, and literally the next day I was in Colorado.
Crazy, man. Not a bad trip, not a bad problem to have. Oh man, this buck just came closer. I mean, when you only have one day to hunt, you know, that's a good problem to have.
It was, because last year I was literally within 100 yards of this same spot where I shot this buck, and I had a little 3-point in front of me and a nice buck behind him, and I literally drew, and this little buck walked in front of this buck, and then he walked behind him, and I let down and I let it pass, and then I went home empty-handed. So I was like, yeah, I learned my lesson. I'm just gonna, you know. And honestly, man, I think I texted Steve on the satellite texter. I was like, there's just nothing like shooting a high country buck, especially solo. It's just,
yeah.
Yeah,
there's something about it. I don't care how big they are. It's just awesome.
That's cool. Yeah, and that was, you said that was Saturday, right?
I think that was Saturday.
Yeah, and you guys leave it like midnight Saturday night? Yeah. Oh, that was the plan anyway.
Yeah.
Because he was watching football till 1.
Boise State game was on.
Yeah. So actually, I must check him on Friday.
I shot him Friday. Yeah.
Yeah. I shot him on Friday. So I got home. I got home late Friday. Yep. And then we left on Saturday.
Yeah.
Saturday night. Yep.
Cool.
So any lessons learned from that hunt, or lessons applied from the past, Lenny, that worked for you on that and help you get that buck killed within a 24-hour hunt?
You know, obviously years of scouting has paid off, you know, to kind of know where to go, because you can't just throw a dart at a map and do that in 24 hours. I firmly believe that, unless you just got lucky. So literally that's just like years of scouting. I'm like, okay, with what time of the season it is and everything else, this is the highest likelihood kind of area where I thought I could go and get on a buck.
What is it about that area, Lenny, that you think the reason that area is holding the deer? Like that specific, I mean, you mentioned you've on the hillside before, you've killed deer there before. So as you look at that, yeah, it's because of scouting and you know it, but as you look at it, why does it work for the deer, do you think?
Well, you know, so those summer bucks, they're usually like, you know, above the tree line. And it seems like as soon as they start dropping their velvet, you know, they'll drop down and they'll kind of get into that kind of in-between area that's got more trees, more brush, but, you know, still an open hillside there, here and there. And that's kind of what this area is. It's kind of like a little bit of an in-between area. It's not like full-on timber where, as a bow hunter, you have no opportunity. But it's not that higher stuff where the bucks have dropped out of it by the second week of September for us over here in Idaho. So it's kind of like this little in between area. And, you know, with bow hunting and mule deer, like, you have to hunt an area that is huntable. And this area definitely has that. You know, it's got, you know, enough terrain there where you can kind of get around and be successful there.
Yeah. Cool.
Nice.
Yeah. And then besides that, I mean, it's just patience, honestly. Like I said, I literally probably moved like 5 feet in 30 minutes trying to just wait for that thermal to push up that would rustle. And then literally once one would rustle, I would, you know, kind of, because everything was so dry. It was just so dry. I would like run like 5 feet because I knew he couldn't see me. It was just the fact of him hearing me. So I literally just like run 5 or 10 feet as fast as I could. And then I'd have to wait for the next gust. And that could be 5 minutes later or 30 minutes later. You know, like knowing you have that one opportunity and there's not a second one, you really slow everything down, which I think helped. I mean, I really think I would have had a shot opportunity at that big buck if that little buck wouldn't have came in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, you know, honestly, like just hunting and being out there, and I don't care, he wasn't a giant. I mean, I killed a nice buck on that same hillside, and it was nearly as cool shooting this buck there, you know, a couple years later. Like it doesn't matter. It's just being out there.
Yeah. Cool. So, Steve, you didn't really get out much for deer, did you, before Colorado?
No, I went. Yeah, I did the same as Lenny, but I went for elk. I went for 24-hour, like super quick trip, I didn't even touch an elk. I mean, I heard like 2 bugles, and yeah, that was it. It was super hot, and I had a very slow hunt for sure.
Yeah. I mean, as we mentioned, you guys took off for Colorado. We talked a bit about that in a previous episode with guys from Born and Raised Outdoors, the plans that you guys had to meet up with them in Colorado. We're not going to hit that tonight because we're actually going to get the Born and Raised crew back on and swap some stories and many laughs, I'm sure, about that trip. So
listeners, there might be one or two laughs.
Yeah, listeners, hang on for that one. It was a successful hunt in some ways, a wild hunt in a bunch of ways, I know for sure. So we're actually going to do a whole episode about that in the weeks to come. So I guess chronologically, I was up next. So headed to Colorado myself with my buddy Jared that I've been hunting with for a few years. We were headed into an area that we hunted 3 years ago. We're able to take a bull out of 3 years ago. Incredibly excited to get back in there. It was the two of us and four goats, so that was a fun, because we always have a little bit of entertainment getting the goats packed in there. But yeah, drove out from the Midwest, did the normal deal, pack in, no problem. A little bit of rain on the pack in, but good day, excited to get there. And then, man, the first day, you know, you always, like you were saying, Lenny, even with your deer, like if you have a spot that you've had some success, you kind of want to favor that, at least check it out. And that's how we felt with this hunt. Mm-hmm. On our previous hunt in this area 3 years ago, obviously a lot can change in 3 years, but we had two of the funnest, just most exciting, crazy, intense elk hunting that we've ever had there. I mean, just bulls. Like, we were at one point on that previous trip just triangulated between three bulls screaming at us, had multiple bulls coming in. We almost shot bulls within seconds of each other. So, you know, we know, right, that that's not going to be that way 3 years later just because it was that way then, but we want to check that area out. And so we went to that area, that exact kind of ridge that first day. And the conditions were rough. It was just a little bit windy. We covered 5+ miles that first day, all off trail, just through freaking timber, hoping to get into these bulls, hiding out, and really just had that first day one encounter. And it was crazy. It was one of these deals where between the winds being on and off, we were throwing out calls when we can, but much of the time the wind was just making calls ineffective. But yeah, we, at one point we threw out this bugle, just kind of trying to throw a locator out, get something going on. And within seconds, a massive, at least 6x6 hops up like 50 yards away. Must've been bedded just below us. And so he hears the bugle, doesn't make a peep, just comes up out of his bed, starts to come up towards us. I drop back to start calling. But of course, as they do, he circled to play the wind. And so like that encounter was over as quick as it started, you know, but it was wild to throw out this locator and, it, you know, hoping to hear something maybe a few hundred yards away and then just have this massive bull pop right up that we just happened to be right on top of. So it was a pretty crazy start, for the first day and good times.
So had you been bugling before that point, or did you guys kind of hike and then get to a point and bugle?
We had been a little bit, but really, like I said, the wind was just making the calls somewhat effective, or ineffective, I should say. And to be honest with you, like, the wind was the story of the trip, as it always is with elk hunting, right? The wind's never doing what you want it to. It's always switching, it's always moving, things like that. But the wind on this trip for literally almost the entire time of daylight, except for seriously about 2 hours that I can recall, was just nonstop. 25 to 35 constant, 60 mile an hour gusts. I mean, there was points where, like, if we were in exposure, it would be, you know, trying to push us. And so it was super frustrating. You know, if you're trying to hunt elk in September, archery, and you're relying on either hearing them or them being able to hear you and respond, and that's shut down by the wind, it was almost like, okay, what the heck do we do now? You know?
Yep.
Yeah.
It was like there was areas on the south side of this mountain that were glassable. The north side was, you know, timbered. So it was like, do we cover ground? Do we glass? What do we do? I mean, it kind of kills everything, right? That next day we did another 8+ miles and literally got into 2 bowls, tough encounters. But it was to the point, and we didn't figure out exactly till later in the trip. But one scenario we had where we actually stumbled upon a bowl with some cows that was only about 150 yards away. And I sent Jared up to be the shooter on this one, dropped back to call. And we were kind of debriefing after this long encounter, which I can talk about here in a second. But in debriefing this, Jared was like, did you hear his first bugle? And I was like, yeah, I think so. He responded to me. He was like, no, he bugled before you did. And I didn't even hear it. And at this point, this bull's like 150 yards away, maybe, from me.
Wow.
And it was like, if you're 150 yards away and not even really hearing a bugle, that shows you how ineffective things are.
Right.
So, I mean, we just dealt with that. We just dealt with that the whole time. It was like, we got into at least a bowl every day, and considering the conditions, I was actually super happy with that, just to get into a bowl each day. But overall, I mean, it was crazy tough, just crazy tough conditions. And it was like one of these deals where I'm thinking back through the podcasts we've done, and it's like, we've never asked Corey or Paul or one of these, okay, what do you do when you just flat out can't hear, right? And they can't hear you. So it was a game changer. Have you guys hunted in prolonged conditions like that?
Last year?
Funny. Yeah, last year. In Colorado this year, hunting with the born and raised guys, I won't give away too much, but their main tactic is very similar to a Corey's of cover a lot of country and bugle and get a response. And we had, I think, you know, we were there at similar times. We had 2 or 3 days out of the trip that would have been same as you, 20, 30 mile an hour winds. We had a couple nights where trees were falling down around our tents because just getting blown over by the wind. And when you're completely shut. We were like talking about it there. Like if we were at home, we know the country and we would know where to go, where the elk would be, and you could at least still hunt it. But when you're relying on physically, like you don't know the country and you're just trying to chase bugles, yeah, you're shut down when you get that kind of weather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we had some idea where they would be holed up, I think, in terms of not only hunting pressure, but and what we thought would be from the wind. And part of that was to be on that north side, because most of the winds for us were coming out of the south or southwest. And so, you know, the north side of this ridge, more timbered, a bit more security, you know, hopefully the ridge is breaking some of the wind. And so we were trying that for sure, and it helped. I mean, the encounters that we had more so were on that north side, but it was still one of these deals where it was like you had to cover ground and almost luck your way into getting on a bull. And obviously it wasn't all just luck, right? Like you're looking for sign, you're looking for what's fresh sign, and that helped a few times. You know, being able to kind of follow sign helped for sure. But overall, yeah, it was just tough. It was really tough. So that one encounter I kind of mentioned, we essentially were hiking. We were trying to get from point A to point B, kind of like it was late afternoon. We wanted to get into a certain area for the evening. And so we were just kind of hoofing it and started to step out into a clearing and spot a bull with 4 or 5 cows feeding out in the open in a small meadow. And it was, I don't know, 3:30, 4 in the afternoon. And so that was that encounter where I kind of sent Jared up to be the shooter, dropped back to be the caller. And it was a fun scenario and how it played out. In the end, calling, it was pretty cool. Pulled this bull across the meadow, downhill and away from cows. So to get any of that, I was pretty stoked with, you know, in terms of him responding to the calls and that. But in the end, you know, kind of the scenario you often get, right? He came so far through the meadow. I had dropped back into the timber. He shouldn't have been to the point where he expected to see me in terms of the bull that was calling and challenging him. But still, he could just see that something was up. But I called him within 60 yards to Jared, but he just, it was quarter and two pretty hard. And in the end, I think that bull was like, all right, I've came this far. I left my cows. I'm not coming all the way. And so he kind of, he went back to the cows, which, you know, getting a bull across a meadow if he's solo is tough. Getting him downhill is tough. Getting him across a meadow and downhill and away from cows is super tough. So, I was hoping that was the encounter that was gonna give us the shot opportunity, but it wasn't. We had, I think, a total of 4 or 5 bulls within 60, 70 yards, but just none closer or none with a good shot opportunity at that distance. So yeah. And then in the end, our trip got cut short as well. So it's like one of these deals where being from the Midwest and traveling to go on a hunt, you know, kind of like what you guys dealt with in Alaska, you hope that when you go and make this trip, you're going to get to hunt as much as possible. And obviously with Alaska, you're kind of expecting that you're essentially going to lose some days to weather, right?
Right.
We've never had to lose any days to weather going to Colorado, but we got 2 or 3 fronts that came through during the week while we were there. And dropped, some rain. It was, again, high winds the whole time, dropped snow. All of that was kind of not forecasted, which obviously a forecast in the mountains don't mean much. But we did have a little bit of service in certain spots, and we're keeping an eye on the weather. And in town for Saturday and Sunday, they were predicting a pretty good thumping of snow on Saturday and Sunday. And so we were considering, here we are like several thousand feet higher. How is it going to get up here type thing, and debating that. And so kept an eye on the weather throughout the week, and the forecast just kept getting worse and worse. And then woke up Friday morning, and nothing was supposed to start till Saturday, but Friday morning it was already coming down up on the mountain. And then where we were, our access road essentially to the trail, we had to take to get out. We had to go up and over a mountain pass that was all, you know, unmaintained road. And so ultimately we're like at the point of, if we get the snow that they're saying they're going to get in town, we're going to be stuck here another 2 to 3 days, maybe, you know, just because of the roads. You know, we had to climb up over a mountain pass on an unmaintained road. And so we were hoping to hunt through Saturday, Sunday, but ended up having to come out a bit early because of that. And, you know, looking at what happened there, it was probably a good thing that we did, or we would have risked running out of food or, you know, getting divorced for getting home 3 days late or something like that. So that's the other, you know, that's the other big bummer. And the other thing you deal with is just, you know, you just can't control the conditions. You know, and so I don't know, in the end, like it was one of these deals where it was like you come back from a hunt that was frustrating because of the conditions, obviously somewhat disappointing because you didn't fill a tag, but at the same time I looked at the way that we hunted, the encounters that we had considering the conditions, and in the end I just, you know, I can't really be disappointed. And then ultimately in the end, it was a freaking blast to spend a week out in the mountains, you know, and despite, you know, the frustration of the hunting, it was just like, there's nothing like just being out there. So it was both frustrating and, you know, like any other trip, highs and lows and all kinds of stuff like that, but it was a good time.
Any, gear things that worked for you, didn't work for you?
Yeah. It was kind of funny. I was looking at the forecast before the trip and kind of on the fence of finalizing like clothing. And, you know, a lot of times I won't take rain gear unless it looks like I'm really going to need it. Yeah. And it was kind of enough precipitation in the forecast. Like, yeah, I think I'm going to at least take the jacket. I pretty much hate wearing rain pants. But it's like, yeah, I'm going to take the rain jacket. And I was kind of on the fence the whole time about taking the new First Light Sawtooth or hybrid. Versus the Uncompahgre, which I always take, and I can't imagine not having it in my pack, but I was like, I don't know, let's see what the Sawtooth can do, you know? So I was kind of on the fence. And so because I think the Uncompahgre is more versatile in the sense that it has DWR, it's going to stand up to weather a little bit better, but I was really curious to see how the Sawtooth would perform in terms of providing insulation, which it has, but also, you know, being more breathable when you are active. Because as soon as you start moving in the Uncompahgre, it can just get ridiculous. I mean, the things, you know, can be a furnace.
Yeah.
And so in the end, since because I was taking the rain gear, I was a little less concerned with, you know, the weather resistance of the sawtooth and really wanted to see how it would perform. And, you know, so I had the conditions to really test that. I mean, we had temps from the 70s and really most nights it was down into the 20s. We were getting a good hard freeze every night. And I was actually blown away with it. I was super impressed with it. It was one of these pieces when it came out, I was excited, but at the same time, I'm like, you know, like how does it fit like in the total context of things? Mm-hmm. But I was incredibly impressed with something that I hoped it would excel at. And it did for me in terms of providing warmth and insulation, yet not overheating you too quickly when you start to move. So for stop and go stuff, you know, like it kept me warm, but it was one of these deals where like my buddy had the Uncompahgre, which, you know, again, great jacket, absolutely love it, but you start to move in it and you're overheating really quick. Mm-hmm. And so for me with the breathability, kind of the hybrid approach of having the core insulated with the sawtooth and then the merino elsewhere, especially like on the back where it's breathable, up near your pits where it's going to be a bit more breathable, it really did perform really well. And I was impressed with the warmth of it. You know, just having that and then a couple light merino layers and being in the 20s, you know, it kept me plenty warm for that. So that was kind of a standout for me. It was kind of interesting because, you know, I'd played with it. I'd worn it before this, but it was like the first test of getting it into a bunch of varied conditions and was super happy with it. So yeah, that was good. I mean, you know, little things like the, you know, I was wearing Quest 4Ds again, the Salomons, which I have several times now, but just again, like on this trip, they were so comfortable, you know, just no blisters, no hot spots, didn't have to do a liner sock, didn't have to do any bandages, didn't have to do any tape, didn't have to do anything, just put the boots on and go. You know, they saw quite a bit of moisture and they are a couple of years old now, so I did get some moisture inside, so I think that's the downside to them. I think overall durability can be the downside to those, but at the same time, it's like for the wear you get out of the price, you know, because you can find them on sale. It's like it's still tough to beat, even if you have to go through a pair every year, you know? So yeah.
Yep.
It was like another deal with those where they just continued to impress me. You know, little things like the first light gaiters were key on this trip for sure in terms of helping keep dry there. Tried some of the food options. You know, I did a bunch of my DIY meals that I've talked about, the dehydrated stuff. That all worked fantastic. I was able to try some of the options from Off Grid Food Company, so kind of a newer startup option. Has some breakfast options and snack options, and really, really good stuff. I think we're going to get him on the podcast, because, yeah, just super good stuff there. I was really happy with that. But, yeah, I mean, overall, a lot of the gear, you know, is the same thing that I continue to use. It's already proven itself, but...
How about the stove?
The stove worked really well. You know, it was definitely one of these deals where I'm sitting there and it's like, you know, of all the times, of all the trips, maybe I should have brought the wind burner just because of the conditions, right?
What stove was it?
I ran a little GSI cook set and then this little Optimus, the Crux Light stove. So it's not an all-in-one system like a jet boiler or the MSR. It's more of the old, you know, just standalone stove and cook set and mini. Super small package. I think everything, you know, is 10 ounces or under. So I had my little, you know, little homemade foil windscreen. Used that a little bit. But, yeah, the stove worked well overall. Didn't have any issues there. Obviously, the boil times weren't as quick as when we were doing testing at home or even testing from a little fan. Cause it was, you know, we'd get up in the morning and be in the 20s and windy. So it's like, yeah, there's going to be, you know, it's going to slow things down, but I was still impressed with it overall. Overall it did great. So yeah, it was a good one. What did you end up running, Steve? Did you mix and match or?
No, I pretty much ran the jet boil the whole time. We did.
Did you?
we, we brought a Jetboil and the MSR Windburner up to Alaska, and Lenny was the dedicated one with the MSR, and I think he was like ready to chuck that thing off a cliff by the end of it.
Yeah, that thing's got. I don't know how they try to sell it as a premium product to the Jetboil. I wanted to like it. Like I wanted
what
to.
Did
like
you
I went
like?
Into it like. Oh, the fact that every time you try to start it, it goes out again. So, I mean, right, yeah. Okay, I can get over the fact I got to carry a lighter. All right. Yeah. I think that's ridiculous in this day and age, but okay, I get it. I'll carry a lighter. And then up there, you know, in the wind, you first try to start that thing, and you start it, and you think it started, and then you, you know, put the pot on top, and you sit there, and like, well, nothing's happening. And, oh, it blew out. Like, it's a wind burner. Like, yeah, come on. Like, you know, it basically won't hold, you know, until you get it started and get it hot. It had a really difficult time of in the wind starting.
Yeah.
Like, I think
it, was, Steve on it happened multiple times where we were both making coffee at the same time. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did. But yeah, we'd make coffee at the same time and my water would be boiling and Lenny would look back down and go, what the hell? And then figure out it blew out. So, yeah, like I said, once it gets going, it's fine, but it's kind of like, you know, it's just one of those little nuanced, annoying things that you got to start it, like hold it super close to your body for 30 seconds until it gets warm and then, then you're good. But that's just kind of stuff, you know, you just want to crank that thing up and start glassing and then wait for your coffee to be hot. So,
yeah.
I think that was probably the main issue, wasn't it? And not having an igniter, just being super annoying, always having to dig a lighter out.
Yeah,
not having the igniter and then being really difficult to start in the wind was, I think, the by far the biggest issue. Oh, and then also the markings on it. Like, it has like 1.2 liters or like, I can't remember what it was. Like, why don't you put 8 ounces and 16 ounces? I don't want to have to do math when I'm in the mountains.
This is America. Really annoying. You got the like, European version.
Did you notice that?
Like, what the heck is a liter?
Yeah,
come on. We use cups here. Honestly, that was annoying.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, no, we use the stove a lot this trip because it's so funny. Like, normally we're always camped in a spot where we're hearing bugles all night and we're waking up in the dark and chasing something first thing in the morning, which sometimes I don't think is necessarily wise because you're chasing an elk that has a mind of its own in terms of getting to bed, but that's a whole different story. So it was funny, like on the second or third morning as we were waking up, freezing cold, high winds, you know, you're not hearing anything that you're super after to chase. So it's like, you know, we wanted to get going, but at the same time, it was so cold. They're like, yeah, let's go ahead and do a quick cup of coffee. So it was funny, on the third day, I told my buddy, I was like, I think I've had more cups of coffee in this trip than I have all of our other trips combined, meaning 3 cups of coffee. Yeah. So
That's funny.
But God, when you're freaking out there and it's in the 20s, a cup of coffee is a lifesaver.
Oh, yeah. When it's in the 40s, we have a cup of coffee, like every 30 minutes.
Yeah,
we have bulls bugling like, let's have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, so it was good overall. I mean, everything else, I can't think of any, you know, major like catastrophes. The goats did great again. It was funny after, you know, because we put the miles on each day, and then even packing out, like, literally the goats were pushing us to the truck. I mean, they're in such good shape this year. It was nice to have them loaded up. And, I mean, they just kicked butt. They didn't slow us down at all, so it was nice. I think the main downside to the goats was anytime we would stop for gas, we were little truck stop celebrities because the goat's in the back of the truck.
Nice.
So it was like everybody's wanting to, like, oh, hey, the goats, huh? So it was funny. We actually had a truck stop in Kansas on the way home and pulled up right behind some other dude who was out in Colorado hunting. So we spent like 10 minutes talking to him, go in the gas station, have another conversation, come back out. Some other guy's like, hey, how'd the goats do? And he starts talking to us. He's like, yeah, I've heard about hunting with pack goats on a podcast that I listened to. And I didn't, like, I'm so far from wanting the attention of that I didn't even say anything. But of course my buddy was like, oh yeah, what podcast is that? The Hunt Backcountry podcast. He's like, oh yeah, that's the one, I love that thing. And so I'm quiet through the whole thing. Until my buddy's like, yeah, that's him right there. You're looking at him. So then that turned into a whole nother conversation, which I just kind of dread getting that type of attention. But yeah, it was pretty funny.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So on the goats, I just got to ask, so do they hunt with you all day, or you guys tie them up and then go hunting?
No, we keep them with us all day.
But like when you're calling in a bull, the caller kind of has them back there? Is that kind of how it works?
In that situation, like those encounters we've had where it's like, okay, you know, shooter go up here, caller come back, the caller will try and pull them back as much as he can. In the end, like they want to be between the two of us all the time, regardless of what that looks like. So whether that's hiking in, hiking out, whether that's hunting, it's like 99% of the time they want to be between the two of you. So it works out, you know, pretty okay, because they're never out getting ahead of the shooter or anything. And usually able to keep them a little bit closer back to the caller. We had them, you know, when I shot my bull last year, I was maybe 12 yards from the bull and they weren't far behind me at all. So, I mean, they were right there. They go with us the whole time. And, you know, as soon as we kind of stop, they kind of stop. If we stop for, you know, more than a minute, they'll go ahead and sit down and just chill. And then we want to get up and go, and they'll get up and get going. But yeah, it hasn't been an issue. If anything, they've helped us spot some game, just watching their behavior. They can kind of sense stuff going on a lot of times before we can, but yeah, we keep them with us, literally the whole time.
Cool.
Yeah. So let's talk about you guys. I mean, you actually got to shoot something, so enough of my boring story. Let's talk about Idaho elk hunting.
Oh, we love Idaho. We gotta
everybody
get you out here.
Everybody go to Colorado.
Yeah, we love Idaho. No, I mean, like Colorado. Yeah, short of it is, Colorado's got like way bigger bulls, probably just as many, more hunters. In Idaho, it seemed like, at least where we hunt, definitely smaller bulls, but you know, at least we knew where to get away from the people.
Yeah. Did you guys run into hunters when we were out there in Colorado?
Yeah,
there was all these dang out of state guys.
Yeah, we didn't see a soul.
No you kids. Guys,
yeah, which is the first time. But I mean, normally we don't see many people, but we'll run into like one or two in the course of a week. But we saw one guy packing in near the trailhead as we were packing out to leave. But we like yeah, the whole time we were out there, we didn't see a soul, which was pretty rad.
Yeah, that was our, I'd say that was the downfall of Colorado, was just running at hunters left and right.
Oh.
And we were fairly, you know, we weren't like that close to a truck by any means. You know, we were back in there a little ways. I think it was just a popular area.
Yeah.
We'd never been there. That born and raised guys had never been there. So it was just a shot in the dark and kind of went into a good spot for elk, but also a place that apparently a lot of other people knew about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the beauty of Idaho is, yeah, we know where to go and get away from people and not see another soul.
Yeah, but there's no elk there, so nobody go there.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But you did find that one elk that you killed, so let's talk about that.
Yeah, we got to find the slow and dumb ones for us to kill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Steve and I...
After Colorado, this was just what, last weekend?
Wednesday.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Wednesday. Yeah, not quite a week ago.
Yeah.
So... You know, between, like you said, not getting divorced and not letting the company tank, like, you know, you're trying to balance all that, you know, make sure the job's going good and the wife and the kids are good. Steve and I were able to sneak out on Wednesday morning. And it's a spot that we've hunted. I mean, on the short trips, I mean, that's the key thing is what you say, Steve, like, you've got to go to a place that you kind of have where you don't have to do much scouting.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, if you only got a short time, you definitely need to know where you're going, you know. And we knew one thing that had happened while we were gone, we got snow in Colorado, but we really got snow here in Idaho, which we didn't even know about till we got back. And knowing that it snowed, it's a lesson we've learned over the years, is the elk, especially in that country, they immediately start pushing out of there down into lower country. So we knew going in that finding the snow line was going to be important, because there's probably a good chance the elk were following that, the snow line back up the mountain, and also, you know, just knew to start lower than we normally would have had we not had that big snowstorm.
Mm. Yeah, so we got in there. It's several hour drive from where we live. And, you know, it's from the bottom to the top, I think it's almost 3,000 feet. And, you know, which is a push, you know, with all your backpacking gear in there. But it was pretty awesome this time. I mean, I don't think we'd went a quarter mile. We're going to ripped off a bugle and you're like, yeah, right. Like we're going to hear anything. And freaking man, a bull hit us right there, super low. And, you know, just one of those deals that we thought he was lower. We kind of tried to get in on the top of him. He ended up being above us, and we think he winded us and blew out of there. And then so we kind of worked our way kind of up around this big mountain, and it was kind of a gnarly side hill trying to get in there. But finally got in there to kind of where we'd hunted before. And, you know, we learned a lot from hunting with the Born and Raised guys, kind of some bugle and stuff, which, like I said, we can talk about later. But we were having really good success at locating bulls, and I can't remember. I think just one bull fired there, didn't he?
Yeah, I think we got to mid mountain.
I think one bull fired off, and Steve was calling because he'd already killed a bull in Colorado, so he kind of gave me first shot.
Yep. Yeah. So we got one thing that was just an important side note is we knew the country, and one thing we do a good job of is marking on our GPS like. Wallows that we find and bedding areas, and I think if you're out hunting and you're going to hunt an area year after year, always mark that stuff so you really plan your way in. And you know, we had this wallow marked in this area that we went to, and we knew, all right, let's sight, and we sighthill across the canyon into it, and got within like 200 yards of the wallow, ripped off a bugle, and I think that bull was right there at that wallow.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, he fired right back at us and did the whole, you know, a little bit of chase thing. He just kept kind of pushing away, and probably covered, what do you say, 400 or 500 yards, something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And finally kind of got to where we ran out of timber. It was a big open sagebrush hillside, and the bull didn't want to go up in that open, so he kind of went up the hill and then got up on this little knob and got stuck up there. And then we're heading towards that bugle, and I think Lenny, you were 10 feet in front of me, and we're just moving. I think it's really important to keep your eyes up in that situation. Lenny, I'm getting like crazy breathing from you.
I am your father.
I was trying to like do that.
I wonder why you're so distracted.
I thought you fired up your CPAP machine there, Lenny.
All right, let me get this thing away from my mouth.
Sorry, I had to stop that one. That would have been bad.
Normally, so, edit that stuff, but I like it. That's staying in.
try sleeping next to this guy.
Same 10 anymore.
Do you have a solar powered CPAP, Lenny? How does that work? How do you?
Dude, I just risk it, man. Freaking heart attack or whatever, and just go for it.
So the bull was just pushing away from us, and finally got to that opening, and he kind of went up the hill, and then we were just basically chasing that bugle. But I think it's, you know, if you're into where you know there's a lot of elk, you know, keep your eyes up, because we were moving along, and Lenny just immediately hit the brakes, pointed up the hill, and he had just caught movement out of the right side, and there was a couple cows and a little spike, right? And then the bull that you end up killing, just up there on the hill, like 100 yards. And meanwhile, the bull that was bugling was like 200 yards away from us, but, you know, we really couldn't move at that point. We were stuck there. Lenny, you can keep taking it.
Yeah, so we kind of moved up the edge of this timber. So we had this bull who was just literally just screaming every time. So Steve's back behind me in the timber bugling. I kind of move up to the edge of the timber, and this bull is just ripping. I mean, he's just pissed. And so, you know, my first instinct is I want to go after him. But then I looked up on this hill, and I see this little 5-point up there, and he's maybe 150 yards up the hill. And so, you know, I definitely have a little bit of a habit. Like, if I can see an elk, you know, there's like one more advantage. So I was watching him, and I was going to kill, you know, basically anything. You know, I wasn't going to be picky. And so I'm kind of watching him, trying to figure out what's going on. This other bull's bugling, and I keep thinking the other bull's going to come in because there's some timber, and I thought he might come down this ridge. And at one point, I actually went back to Steve, and I was going to say, hey, let's reposition, try to circle around this elk that's bugling up on this knob. We'll just leave this other smaller bull alone because nothing's going to happen. But when I went back to Steve, that bigger bull, he must have turned his head and ripped. I'm like, oh, my God, he's coming. And I ran back out to the edge of the timber and was kind of waiting there. And while that was all happening, it was kind of interesting watching this young bull. He was just a rag, just a 5-point. And, pretty soon I kind of see him. He kind of, throwing his head up a little bit, kind of shaking his head. And, because I can see it, it's kind of wide open, just a few trees between us. And then and Steve's back there raking as well. And pretty soon this bull goes to raking. And once that bull started raking, I'm like, all right, he's getting into this. And, I kind of thought, like, if we can kind of keep him and that other bull's bugling and Steve's bugling, there's just a ton of excitement going on right then. And next thing I know, he's kind of, you can do kind of just the way they're standing. He's looking down the hill. You can tell he wants to come. And poor Steve, I think he'd been back there for about 15 minutes just bugling and raking, and he could see what the heck was going on. And I'm sure he probably thought I was crazy because I was taking such a long time. But, it was neat to watch this bull go from I'm scared, I'm getting out of here, to I'm kind of curious, to kind of shaking his head, raking a tree, take a couple steps down. And I just kind of watched all that play out. And I'm like, he's getting into it. He's getting into it. He's getting worked up. He's getting worked up. He's getting worked up. And then next thing I know, man, he comes down the hill. And took him a little bit to get down there. He's still a little hesitant, you can tell, just because he's a younger bull. And he'd kind of stop behind a tree. And then Steve would bugle. The other bull on the other hill would bugle. And, I definitely had to kind of reposition myself kind of to where he was coming in. I mean, that's one thing I've definitely learned over the years is as a shooter, you can't just sit there and hope that the caller calls a bull in perfect. You've got to make sure that you reposition yourself. And 10 years ago, I would have just sat there and that bull would have came in the wrong lane. I've been like, oh, shoot, he came in the wrong way. But I kind of had to work my way up the hill just a little bit and get positioned. And that bull came in the perfect lane, literally 30 yards, I think. And cow call, wah, stopped him. Whack. I just see a tuft of hair right through the lungs. I didn't even watch him fall down. I knew he's dead. And I literally he's dead, turned around, ran down the hill, grabbed the bugle from Steve. I said, grab your bow. Let's call this other bull in. Cause this other bull, man, it sounded like he was right there and was coming down the hill. Yeah. And so I grabbed the bugle and start ripping on it. And Steve grabs his bow. But I think what happened is my bull ran up the hill like 50 yards and died and then rolled down the hill. And that other bull was kind of up on the knob and saw that and was like, what just happened there? Because it was pretty much immediately he shut up after that. So it was awesome. 30 yard shot, double lung. He went up, he didn't go very far at all, rolled down the hill dead. So Steve and I, it was getting towards the evening, we quartered him out, and it was super cold, and in the timber there's still 6-8 inches of snow. So we got him all cleaned up, hung him up. And so we had to get Steve a bull next. And so we camped kind of right there close that night. And we thought we were going to hear bugles all around us. We didn't hear a single bugle. So I'll let you kind of kick off the rest of the
story. One thing, to just go back to Lenny's bull, it was kind of an interesting scenario because the bull he killed never – at one point he had bugled. And I remember looking at Lenny and saying two fingers up. And like, holy crap, there's two bulls there. But after that, he never said another word. And we were trying to figure out some lesson to learn from that scenario. Unfortunately, there just wasn't one because that bull never said a word, just sat up on the hill and started raking a tree and then eventually came in and Lenny shot it. But I think I don't know, Lenny, was there anything you could have gleaned from that and what you would do different? I mean, other than we just got lucky and it was open country that you could see him up there.
Well, it's funny. Afterwards I thought about it and I thought, man, how many times have I been in a situation where we called for 10 minutes and not 15 minutes and there was a bull sitting out there out of sight at 150, 200 yards that was getting worked up and he just needed time.
Yeah.
To kind of get that, he needed to rake a tree and he kind of, he just needed that little bit, I don't want to, it's like a woman, you know, kind of needed to slowly get worked up, right? I mean, not fast.
Steve's down there working that foreplay and this bull's,
yeah. No, literally, I mean, that's what it was like. And you could see him, you could just see him starting to get into it and kind of get a little confidence and, you know, kind of rake that tree. And it's like, man, I'm going to go check this out. So it always seems longer than what it was. I mean, do you think it was 10 minutes? Maybe it wasn't even that long. Maybe
it was. I don't know. It seemed like it, yeah. But who knows?
Yeah. Those moments are always so hard to gauge.
I guess maybe it was only between 5 and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Realistically.
I've ran into that before, though. I mean, where, you know, you're working a bull, and then out of nowhere, a bull that hasn't made a peep, you didn't even know he was around, he ends up moseying his way in. And sometimes it's cautiously, I think, just because they don't want to get their butts kicked. But yeah, I've seen that dynamic play out for sure. And I'm not sure how you, as a hunter, respond to that other than just be aware of it. You know what I mean? Like, be aware of that possibility.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's a tough call because we're, you know, trying to be super aggressive. But at the same time, in that scenario, just being patient and letting that play out was the right decision. And I don't know, you know. I think more than anything, maybe you just got to stick with either being super patient all the time or being super aggressive and maybe not bouncing back and forth between the two. Because maybe if we were really aggressive, we would have killed a bigger herd bull. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking right there. I mean, because if I would have backed out and circled back up to get on that herd bull, which was hitting us every single time, you know, I actually think he was super, super killable bull, and he may have came in. But the kind of, for me, the money was on the one I could see and, you know, there was a lot less variables there than going after that big bull.
Yeah.
So from there, we hung Lenny's meat up, and then in the morning we were jacked. You know, I already have elk meat in the freezer from Colorado, so I was just like, pressure's off. We just got, you know, all day Thursday and Friday to just kind of enjoy the hunt and see what happens. And told Lenny it was either going to be a 300-inch bull or a spike, one of the two. I already shot a raghorn, so I was like, if I'm going to get some meat, it's going to be some tasty, delicious spike, or, you know, it's going to be a big bull. You know, for whatever reason, we were compelled to, like, go higher. I think that's our natural, in our DNA, to, like, go to the top, and the further away, the better. So the next day, we thought the bull that we had got on had went, you know, basically to the west and away from us up the canyon. So that's where we went in the morning, and we actually kind of got up there, and the higher we got, the more snow we got into, and basically wasted half a day up high, realizing that, you know, okay, now we need to get back down lower. And once we dropped down, you know, had to cover some serious elevation and country to get down a couple canyons lower. By like late afternoon, we had we had like a 24 hours of just about the most epic elk hunting you could have, with, you know, bulls bugling left and right. One of the bulls in particular, we got on, he was screaming. And this is just one of those, you know, I would love to have really like Cody or Trent from Born and Raised. Those guys are phenomenal elk callers, or Corey Jacobson with us, or Paul Mandel, you know, because we got in a scenario where a bull was screaming, you know, we had like 50 yards like open country between us and him, and then we were set up right, and, you know, we couldn't get that bull to come across that opening, and we know that's hard, but it was a frustrating scenario because we were basically stuck. You know, the bull's right there screaming, we can't get any closer, he's not coming to us, and you just wonder if you made a certain sound or did something differently, if you could get him, you know, mad enough to come across that opening. But I think it was like, I don't know, I'd say a good hour or 2 hours, Lenny, that we messed with that bull. I mean,
worn out. Yeah, poor Lenny. I was just like, kill that thing. I'm so tired from raking and calling.
poor Lenny was just freaking haggard. And I'm sitting there just shooting her the whole time, just like trying to figure out what to do. And eventually we saw the bull work up the canyon a little bit, not, you know, like 200 feet above us, and he had one cow with him. He came out of this timber patch, and it was a pretty cool, you know, it was one of those awesome moments where we saw them feeding out. We went up higher. We're still on this little finger ridge with a little bit of open country between us, and there's this big rock up on the finger ridge, and I kind of got up, you know, got like hunched over, crawled up to that rock, got right next to it, and I was just trying to glass and see that bull. And I could see the bull, I could see the cow. Lenny's back behind me. He just throws out a few cow calls, and I see the cow disappear. And then literally all of a sudden she pops up at like 8 yards in front of me. There's enough kind of slope to the hill that I didn't see her coming, and then walked within like 3 yards. And I had an arrow knocked and everything. And I, like Lenny was saying, from his perspective, it looked like my broadhead was like literally touching her.
And
I think I could have like thrown my bow out and you know, would have just, it would have hit her. I mean, she was 3 yards away from me. And just sat there forever. And it was just one of those awesome, you know, to have an elk that close to you and not even know you were there. I mean, she she kind of looked at me, but looked right through me and looked back down at Lenny where the cow calls were coming from. And it was a really cool moment. And she ended up busting, but you called her back twice, I think, right?
Yeah. Well, I think I was doing the hyperlip.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so that bull would answer everything. No. He stopped answering, and then you tried the hyperlip.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of shut down a little bit, and he kind of wouldn't talk anymore. And so we pulled out the hyperlip, and then he really hit that hard.
Yeah. Yeah, he was digging that, and that cow was definitely curious what that sound was. And long story short, you know, that the cow busted us, and then I tried to do like a mad, like I knew the cow was going to bust me, and I tried to actually literally sprint and cover country and cut her off before she got to the bull. And it worked, because she ended up kind of going up and over, and then the bull was by himself, and he actually just hung out right there in that area, just bugling and calling. I think he was just trying to get that cow back. And we ended up getting on the ridge, and it was one of those just kind of, you know, break out of jail moments where you just got nothing to lose. And I was literally like running down the freaking ridge, and I could see his tines like just moving away, just kind of over the rise. And I got that bull like 75 yards, you know, at one point, but, you know, just couldn't get enough cover to get closer and get a shot. And then that evening
I don't know. Yeah, I just want to back up on that real quick. I think what was interesting about that is, you know, it's one of those scenarios where it's fun to bugle back and forth, like it's exciting. But that bull was never going to come across because he had a cow sitting there. And so literally, in hindsight, I think the only thing that could bring that bull was basically that cow, which she did. So really, you need to call the cow in order to get the bull. And for whatever reason, we actually think he might have saw us earlier in the scenario, and that's kind of why he didn't come the last bit. But the key there was to call the cow to kill the bull, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately, it didn't quite work out that way, but it almost did.
Yeah.
And anyway, that bull ended up dropping down into another canyon. And once he got down there, he was bugling the whole way down, and then he fired up another couple bulls, and then like from there until the next day was just, you know, off the charts, just running and chasing elk left and right. You know, it was one of those, we probably heard 200 bugles that evening, and there was just so many elk things moving around. I had one bull at like 60 yards raking a tree and just needed him to come 10 yards closer to like get a shooting lane and get a shot. And it's just an awesome experience. And then, the next morning, we ended up hiking. We had to drop in that canyon and then hike a freaking couple thousand feet back out just to find a flat spot to camp. I mean, this damn country is so steep that there's just nowhere to freaking sleep. Got on the ridge, bulls bugling all night long, like to the point where it was annoying, you know, because you're like, okay, it's 3 a.m. I've heard 500 bugles, like, shut up so I can go to sleep, you know. And we woke up, and there was this one bull down from us right where we were at the night before, just doing this lip ball over and over and over and over. It was funny because Paul Medell has an app, which I don't know if we talked about that last time we had him on.
Yeah.
So a cell phone app, and Lenny pulls that up and like, what's lip ball? And it was literally, what was the definition of lip ball? I mean, it was
to keep a hot cow close.
That's right. Yeah. And so, yeah, to keep a hot cow close. And we literally with 10 seconds after that, we see the bull and see a cow. And it was like watching a 3-year-old boy chase a girl around the playground. Like they were literally like, the cow was on the top side of this big tree and he was on the bottom side. And he was like jumping to the right and lip balling at her. And she'd run one way and he'd run around and get in front of her. And they're just doing this over and over and over again. And It was pretty cool to watch. And anyways, we had to drop all the way down the backside of the finger ridge, get below him so we get the thermals so we could work up. Everything scenario played out absolutely perfectly. We got within, probably like he's bugling and screaming just like enough to where we didn't have to make a sound. We just kept getting closer and closer and closer, and finally got to a spot. We were about 100 yards away, thought we were roughly 100 yards away, and I snuck up. Told Lenny to stay, like, all right, you stay here, I'm going to sneak up. I kind of wanted to be aggressive with this. It was kind of open enough country that I felt like that Lenny needed to be pretty far behind me, like 70 yards behind me for me to get a shot at this bull. And so I get up there about 60, 70 yards, kind of give Lenny the thumbs up. And I believe Lenny just broke a branch, and it was kind of a cool tactic that he did. I'm sure other people experienced, like, you get really close on an elk and you let out a cow call or a bugle and they immediately just like freaking hit the gas and run out of the country. And so Lenny just broke a branch to kind of say like, hey, I'm an elk, I'm down here, I'm breaking a branch, you know? And the bull just responded right away to that branch breaking, just screamed back in our direction. And then Lenny screamed, and then I could see his feet up the hill. Literally, and he just starts like on a straight freaking line running right towards Lenny. And I kind of like got the line he was on. And this is where I made some mistakes got the line he was on, knew I had to like get in front of this tree. It was like 8 yards in front of me, got in front of it, got down on my knees. Cause I had to get down below some tree limbs to get a shot. And the two things I screwed up on is, one, I didn't have my reed in my mouth. And I basically was looking at the scenario, and this happened within like 10 seconds of, I didn't have my reed in my mouth. And I'm like, oh crap, I've got one shooting lane. I don't know how I'm going to stop this bull. You know what I mean? You can try to do a cow call with your mouth, but it's not near as effective if you had a reed. And the other one is my rangefinder was in my pocket. And so I got my rangefinder out really quick, ranged the hill, got a reading of 50 yards. Like, okay, that's good. Thought I had a good solid reading. Then I was trying to get my reed out of my pocket and like just basically ran out of time. Bull ran down there, like hit the brakes right before the opening, like looked back over his shoulder on the uphill side, looked at his cow. I drew, he took one more step, stepped out there, put my 50 yard pin on it, did the whole Lenny. Has this awesome mantra of like, you know, in that scenario, don't ever shoot on the first pass, like basically the first pass of your pin through the body. So like, you know, it's just a good way to like calm you down so you don't rush that shot. So, you know, I pass through, settled my pin back down on the second time through, hold 50, think like, and I'm just literally in the back of my head, like, this bull's dead, freaking squeeze the trigger off, arrows, sails over his back, like 2 feet. And I was just like, it would have been the second biggest bull I've ever killed. He was a nice, like, 290, 300 inch bull. And it was, his heart was just sunk. Lenny came, you know, I did 3 cow calls, which signaled that once I shot, the bull was whirled out of there. And I did 3 cow calls, and Lenny came up, and I signaled that he blew off. And Lenny was all pissed off because he thought the bull just, like, ran away from his calls. He didn't know what had happened. I came up and, like, dude, I freaking missed. You know, I was just like, I haven't missed in a while. And ended up, I had him stand right where I was. I went to where the bull was standing. It was 34.7 yards. It was just one of the, you know, I was trying to learn from the situation. And I really think I did everything right, basically, with what I was dealt with just being stupid and not having like quick access to my rangefinder. And you know, you should just, as the shooter, the second I left Lenny to go get up in front, I should have had a reed in my mouth. I don't know why I didn't. It was dumb. Because that would have saved me just a few precious seconds that maybe I could have got a different reading. You know, it's just one of those sagebrush hillsides. There's a few trees and it was just kind of sloped up away from me enough that I think it was super easy to, you know, I could have got a 34 yard reading or a 50 yard reading. I don't know. I think that my lesson from that is literally like, I think next year I've always just carried my rangefinder in my pocket. I might find a way to have that like attached to my chest next to my bino harness. Mm-hmm. And then just make sure you always have your reed in there. But you know, it's a frustrating deal too. Cause I think when he drew and I had my, you know, I was looking through my peep, like he looked to be 50 yards to me. It was kind of deceiving. You know, there wasn't a lot of landmarks, just like a couple trees that I was like looking under the limbs up here on this open hillside at the bull. So just depth perception was off. But yeah, I missed them, and you know, just try to learn from it. And you know, it's I talked to a guy came in the XO office today, and he missed a bull, and I told him my story, and he's like, "Oh man, I feel so much better." You know, like, I'm not the only one that misses, though. Oh God, no. You know, I think we all do it. It happens, and you can do is try to learn from it. And I definitely, you know, I made my mistakes there, so.
Yeah,
that was basically the end of the hunt. We kind of hunted our way back to Lenny's meat, and then we deboned that sucker. And for whatever stupid, foolish reason, just because it's a nasty enough, rocky, crappy climb up in there, we just decided to one trip that thing out. And that was it gets all cliffy at the bottom, and we packed that sucker out in one trip. And Lenny's pack, we weighed it, he had 127 pounds and mine was 112, so definitely some heavy packs coming out of there. But you know, that's the, I think to me that's the best part of it, is that getting that meat out of there and bringing that home. And you know, just the hard work makes the reward that much more rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and the worst part is we weren't too far from when we killed my bull, and I was like, oh man, somebody else killed a bull over here. And I could just see these big old horns sweeping up, and I go walking over there, and it was a dead head from last year. I think, you know, I don't know, maybe rifle hunters or something had shot it, and it's like a 310 bull, just beautiful, like 310-inch bull, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is an awesome bull. Yeah. I'm looking at my little 5-point, and I'm like, gosh, I just leave mine here, but this one.
Yeah, let's do a swap.
Yeah, but I was weighed down so much. I was like, I don't think I can add, even if I take mine off and throw this on, I'm like, I don't think I can do it. So we had to leave that giant deadhead up on the hill.
Yeah, dang. Man.
One thing, I tried out a pair of boots, and holy crap, I'll never do that again. back to my Solomon. So that's all I'm going to say. Like, I was whining so much. I mean, it was the most painful pack out that I've ever freaking had.
Yeah.
I was about to the point where I was just going to take the boots off and just go barefoot with 112 pounds on my back, because I think that would have been better off on the sharp rocks than the boots were. So
yeah.
Yeah, funny. My mistake going away from the Solomons. It was a stupid mistake.
Right. My my buddy, we were on the way home, you know, driving back from the hunt, and he had some issues, and it's not the first year he wore these boots, but he's just not super satisfied with them. So he's talking about shopping and talking about different options. And I'm like, yeah, man, my Solomons are worn out. Maybe I'll shop around. And then I'm thinking, I was like, I don't know. You always want to go see what's out there, but at the same time, when you have something that works, you're just like, nope, I'll just get another pair, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Lenny was rocking a pair of Crispy Summits.
Yep.
Yeah. And you've been enjoying them for the most part.
Yeah, for the most part. You know, it's definitely not the out of box comfort that the Solomons have had, but I've definitely been I don't think comfort wise, Solomons can't be beat. But I've been disappointed by how waterproof they are, or non-waterproof, frankly. Out of the box, almost. I don't know what kind of Gore-Tex they use, but it's just, they're awful. And then it also, my last pair, I think it was second trip, you know, I had a pretty big seam ripping out. You know, and it wasn't like I didn't make them usable. I think I used them for another year after that, but it was just kind of annoying.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I tried these Crispy Summits. They're a little heavier. They're built a little better. And the Gore-Tex is significantly better. I mean, significant. I hunted in a lot of wet weather, and they did. You know, Gore-Tex, for whatever reason, is not perfect. And inevitably, you hike in snow all day. I don't know if it's sweat or going down your boot or whatever. You know, by the end of the day, my feet are wet, but at least it wasn't in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But they have a lot more volume than what the Solomons have. So I did have to work with some different footbeds and this and that to kind of get in, add a little cushioning to them. It definitely took a little more finessing than what my Solomons, but overall I was pretty happy with them.
Yeah. Cool. Well, it sounds like we covered the gamut from, you know, elk hunts without opportunities to missed elk to striking gold. So we covered our bases. Well done, fellas.
Thanks. Yeah.
It was an epic. Awesome year. Epic year, for sure. I think I tallied up and I basically got 24 days, you know, out away from you know, whether that was travel days and field days total since we left for the caribou hunt. So that's we got after it hard, and I'm glad it's October now and kind of get back to drinking beer and watch a little bit of football.
Yeah, it felt like 24 days just the Alaska trip while I was back trying to cover up emails and stuff like that. That felt like 24 days.
Welcome to my world.
Cool. Well, listeners, we will get back to regular scheduled programming here. As we mentioned, have episodes already recorded we want to release soon that are great, have guests lining up, so hopefully you enjoyed this. We definitely want to hear from you. If you have a story to share, let us know. If you have field photos to share, definitely send those to photos@exomountaingear.com, anything like that. As always, if you're enjoying the show, leaving a review in iTunes would help tremendously, and you can always contact us with questions, comments, or feedback to podcasts@exomountaingear.com. Steve, Lenny, thanks for joining us.